Hey folks, this is Craig. Today's episode is a wrap-up episode from our reading group of 1,000 Plateaus, the plateau entitled, How Do You Make Yourself a Body Without Organs? We have an ongoing reading group, as many of you know, and this month we are reading the plateau, a short one, on the refrain. In addition to that reading group, we also have a Bataille reading group that is reading short essays and other preparatory material in anticipation of reading Bataille's The Accursed Share series. If you would like to participate in any one of those reading groups, join us at the $5 level on Patreon. If you just want to be part of the 1,000 Plateaus reading group, you can sign up for as little as $1. Also, those mid-tier patrons who sign up at the $5 level will also be able to join our Discord, where we are all having ongoing discussions of the material. Becoming a member of our Patreon means having access to all of the recordings that we have done previously, and most of the reading group sessions are conducted in a self-contained format, so you never feel left out or left behind. Today, we are talking about the relationship between the practice of autopsy and the concept of a body without organs with our special guest, Austin. Okay, let's take a listen. Welcome to Acid Horizon, the Theory Podcast. Today, we are conducting a wrap-up episode on 1,000 Plateaus. November 28th, 1947, How Do You Make Yourself a Body Without Organs? And for this episode, we brought in a special guest. His name is Austin. And if I am not mistaken, your exact title, Austin, you are a forensic oncologist. Is that correct?
So I've trained in forensics. I did a forensics fellowship, but my current title is I'm the director of autopsy services for the hospital that I work at, which is Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. I don't do forensics right now. I do hospital autopsy. And I can go into that distinction if you want at some point. But I have trained in forensics. I have definitely cut my fair share of homicides, suicides, and things like that. I also do cancer pathology. I'm a microscope doctor. I handle tissue. I look at it under the microscope, and then I produce a report. So I take tissue, I cut it apart, I look at it under the microscope, and then I give reports that go any number of other places. Cancer surgeons, oncologists, any type of physician. Back when I was a forensic pathologist, they went to law enforcement and all manner of carceral bodies. So right now, the majority of what I do is in cancer, diagnosis of cancer, mostly of the head and neck, but also of many other parts of the body, depending on what type of situation arises.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure. I just didn't want to get it wrong. And now the connection's clear to me. All that to say, today on the episode, we have somebody who's literally an expert on bodies without organs and cancerous bodies without organs, as they are referenced in this plateau. So we are very privileged to have you in our presence today. Well, with that said, let's talk a little bit about this chapter. The concept of a body without organs is not limited to the scope of 1,000 Plateaus. We see it in various places in Deleuze and Guattari's work, also in the solo work of Deleuze. And here it's developed in a way that's a little bit different than, let's say, Anti-Oedipus. In fact, one of the key differences that we see in this text is the emphasis that Deleuze and Guattari put on the notion of injecting doses of caution into your experimentation with a body without organs. And I would say that's actually the predominant sort of paradigm that we're working with here, is the construction of a body without organs as a kind of experiment. And there's really a lot we can say, but I would like to get everybody involved in the discussion to have them offer us what stood out to them in the reading. And with us in the chat, we have everybody today. We have Adam, Will, Matt, and of course, Austin. So we'll just kind of go around the room. Typically, I start with Adam, but why don't we start with Will today? Will, what kind of stood out to you in this chapter on the body without organs?
So obviously, like, as a student of Anti-Oedipus and primarily like my reading of the body without organs being your video about it from 2 years ago now, I found the approach here to be far more explicitly ethical, right? The way that they break down the body without organs in this plateau straight from the gate is that it's a series of practices, that it can't be understood as a conceptual armature, that it can't be understood as something that can have analogous relations to other concepts on a plane of immanence, that in fact, it establishes this plane upon which desire can manifest, right? So like desire presupposes a body without organs, which I found to be extremely complicated. But what I appreciated here was the explicit articulation of the fact that the endless attainment of the body without organs is something that has to be pursued as an ethics, as a practice, an art of living, which I think then makes their distinction between desire and pleasure kind of difficult to navigate. But what it also does is it makes their critique of the psychoanalytic appropriation of the real and of the phantasmatic to be extremely compelling. So yeah, for me, it came down primarily to the ways in which like they broke down pleasure and practice, particularly in the various segments on sadomasochism, and the fact that they're always playing this really dangerous line between critiquing interpretosis and collapsing into interpretation. And I actually think that their analysis of sadomasochistic sex and the interplay between the dom and the sub really straddles that dangerous line of collapsing into interpretation. So maybe we'll get to that in other plateaus, other reading groups, when we talk about interpretosis, because it's something that's only deployed like briefly in 1,000 plateaus. But those were my takeaways. I'm excited to talk about it at the level of a set of practices.
Matt, how about you?
So, I mean, we all met, or at least me and Will and Craig met, I suppose, at the start when we were doing an anti-Oedipus reading group. And I remember around that time, we were all trying to figure out what the hell is a body without organs. And, you know, when we started podcast up, one of the early videos was Craig trying to explain what it is. And I'll be honest, I'm still not certain that I have a perfect grasp on it. I think Will's right to emphasize that it's related to ethics and to practices. I think that's right. One thing I hadn't entirely appreciated until I came back to, let's say, this version, the 1,000 plateaus version of the body without organs, because often I end up going back to the anti-Oedipus version, is how explicitly they tie this into Spinoza. Firstly, they make it quite explicit. On my copy, page 178, they say, after all, is not Spinoza's ethics the great book of the BWO? The attributes of types or genuses of BWOs, substances, powers, zero intensities as matrices of production. The modes are everything that comes to pass, waves and migrations, thresholds and gradients. Intensities produced in a given type of substance starting from a given matrix. But one of the other things that sort of stood out to me, it's a very small detail, and maybe I'm making it out of a molehill, but I think Craig mentioned this maybe it was Will, that why these examples, why must we start here? Empty bodies instead of full ones. What happened? Were you cautious enough? Not wisdom. Caution. That's one of the great principles or piece of advice, I think, that Spinoza in the Ethics, his signet ring, he used to sort of stamp his letters and so on, had the Latin caute, which means cautiously. So maybe I'm making Martin Mulhill there. I don't think I am. I think that they're very deliberately drawing parallels here with Spinoza. And, you know, I hope people listening have like some vague sense of what a body without organs is already. But maybe one way of looking at it would be to think back to Spinoza's claim that we don't yet know what a body can do. And so the idea perhaps of a body without organs is to highlight the extent to which we really don't know that. In Anti-Oedipus, for example, they talk about the idea of being organized, body becomes organized in certain ways. And a body without organs is sort of meant to provide us, I think, with a way of thinking about what if it was organized differently, whether that's, you know, I think it's also not meant to just describe, you know, the human body per se. If you think of the idea of assemblages in 1,000 plateaus, which quite a few interpreters think is sort of the central concept in this book, you can see those in exactly the same sort of terms as Spinoza's bodies. And so always the question is, what can this body do? In Anti-Oedipus as well, when we talk about body without organs, they will explicitly talk about body without organs on the sort of social level, the political level, the social field. So there's layers to this. And I think I found it helpful going back and just noting in my own head some of those links with Spinoza, whose work I've obviously been reading a lot recently, thinking in terms of experimentation as an ethical practice, which is central to Spinoza's ethics. And I think it's not surprising that Will's into that with his Foucault, you know, interest as well. And also just as a way of thinking through a kind of ontology as well, larger structures beyond the human individual. What can those bodies do? Right. What could they be? So it's interesting. And yeah, I think particularly when you go back to Anti-Oedipus, maybe this is a secondary point. I don't want to ramble too much. But one of the interesting things for me often is the difference between concepts that you find in Anti-Oedipus and then when you find them again in 1,000 plateaus. Because almost every time they will reappear, but just modified a little bit. It'll have a new inflection or a new implication to it. And I think body of our organs is one of those. And Will's right that part of that is this perhaps more cautious approach to what is possible and how it might be approached. They probably took on board some of the worries or feedback on the anti-ed approach. I'll leave it there for now.
And Adam, what about you?
Yeah, well, it's my interpretation of Deleuze and Guattari plateau. So we need to put away 1,000 plateaus and crack open Kant's first critique, because the origins of the body of our organs comes from, of course, anti-Oedipus, and particularly the early chapter where they talk about the three syntheses of the unconscious. And essentially how the unconscious, how desire connects things, produces things, how networks of connections between desire and partial objects end up allowing desire to flow through circuits and achieve certain ends, certain functions. So to think about the three syntheses of the unconscious, the three syntheses are modeled after the three syntheses of the transcendental imagination in the A deduction in Kant's first critique. Now, I'm not going to go into that too much, but I'm just going to talk about the three syntheses, first of all, in terms of how they're defined in terms of three different logical operators. The first logical operator is for the connective synthesis. This is and. Desire wants this and this. It starts making connections with different objects. They use, for example, the example from famous comes from psychoanalysis of the child connecting to the breast, you know, and the mother and milk, etc., from flows of what is desired to come through. The second synthesis is the disjunctive synthesis, which is determined by the logical operator or. And this is where the body of our organs comes in. Because in this part of anti-Oedipus, essentially the body of our organs is that which allows you to desire this or something else. It's what essentially deactivates connections that desire that you've made in order so that you can record them and essentially recombine them with other structures to desire things differently, so that you can desire differently at all. Because the connections are made in the first synthesis are, in a sense, organizations due to a certain kind of desire. For example, the desire for sustenance, creating a network of inputs and outputs into a kind of circuit, or I guess as we could say, sort of later, a feedback loop. The body of our organs is the thing that these connections are written upon to, so that they can be deactivated and then redeployed or, you know, done later. So, you know, you can repeat the initial desire for milk as the partial object of one's hunger into eventually eating different things or different culinary desires and so forth. And the third synthesis, just to complete the picture here, is the conjunctive synthesis, which is essentially the logical operator of the eye. After connections of desire are made, they're recorded on the body of our organs and essentially deactivated, so you can repeat them and differentiate them and possibly develop them later, there's a residual bit of energy or desire here, which then this residuum is the subject which thinks that it's actually been the main operator the entire time. So I wanted that, and my agency was the thing that wanted it, rather than my desire being the thing that produces the subjectivity that I have. I think this all goes to a very elementary point about the body of our organs, in which it is the precondition of any desiring or of any organization of a body. In order to organize a body, there must be a sort of residual well of plasticity, which contains capacity for both deorganization and the source for reorganization. Similar to, say, examples, say, an Amazon warehouse, you have to pack things and they teach you a certain rhythm of putting things in a sorting boxes into magenta, the light fixtures which determine whether something's been scanned or not. They teach you certain rhythms and motions, similar to how in Foucault's analysis of the barracks, you're organized to raise a rifle a certain way, aim a certain way, march in a certain way. There's a presupposition of a plasticity there, which it must draw upon. Now, of course, it doesn't necessarily mean that a body of our organs is the same body that is organized. Rather, no, you don't sort of use it up and then it's gone, it goes away. It's kind of a constant correlate of desire, because desire is the thing that organizes bodies to achieve certain kinds of ends. And I guess as well, you can think of capital as a kind of body of our organs in this sense. Because if you look at the formula of capital, you know, MCM, so MCM dash, money, commodity, money. Capital is not really capital until it gets to that M dash. The first capital is the body of our organs. That's the thing which is essentially is presupposed by the capitalist desire for the M dash. Otherwise, it's just money. It's the very precondition of that. And it's because you have this precondition that you can now organize other bodies into that circuit to produce the capital, what is desired in capitalist desire or desire of capital, which is the M dash. So insofar as desire can be social, the body of our organs can be social. And I think, particularly we're thinking about what an organ is, we have to turn to sort of the rather classic definition of the organism, which is that it is cause and effect of itself. Organs are functions, rely on inputs and outputs. You ingest sugar, pancreas secretes insulin, stuff like that. The organism is the propulsive system of the body to keep it going towards whatever the body eventually wants to do. So I think in terms of the sort of cybernetic research that we're very much influenced by, the body of our organs is a kind of circuit breaker function, which is the presupposition of, you know, changing any system or organizing any system at the same time as which it's also the ways which systems can be deactivated and organized differently. So, I mean, that was a very sterile way of talking about this plateau, given its incredible horniness, I must say. I mean, Kant's not the first person you think of about, you know, when you talk about sewing various holes up and, you know, trying to turn yourself into a horse so you no longer fancy legs, sort of thing. But it's all in there. It's all in there. It's very cybernetic. Very Kantian circuitry is in this text.
Thank you, Adam. Before we get to Austin, I'll just add a little bit and maybe introduce some terminology that we might be working with. And I'll begin with a quote from the actual text that really stood out to me. And this is in the Minnesota edition on page 164. It says, "Thus, the body without organs is never yours or mine. It is always a body, the indefinite article. It is no more projective than it is regressive. It is an involution, but always a contemporary, creative involution. The organs distribute themselves on the BWO, but they distribute themselves independently of the form of the organism. Forms become contingent. Organs are no longer anything more than intensities that are produced, flows, thresholds, and gradients. A stomach, an eye, a mouth. The indefinite article does not lack anything. It is not indeterminate or undifferentiated, but expresses the pure determination of intensity, intensive difference." And this idea of involution is an interesting one because this is a term, as I understand it, that's used when talking about the necrosis of organs, if I'm not mistaken. The dying of an organ is called an involution. And perhaps one of the ways that we can look at this is within a series of organs, there is this thing which is the body without organs, which allows for this organizing principle. Think about a piano, for example. We put together a piano, it's got keys, it's got the little bench, and it's got the little thing to hold the sheet music. And we've seen people sit at the piano, and when a child goes up to the piano, typically they're doing so in a manner that mimics ways that they've seen folks use pianos before. But then you get somebody like John Cage or these other experimental musicians, and they're slipping strips of paper between the strings. They're getting in there with a hammer. I remember the guys from the band Tool use a shotgun to blow up a piano at one time. There are many different kinds of things you can do with a piano as an instrument, and maybe not as an instrument, but as an instrument experimentally that defy the way that it was intended to be used. And this is one of the ways that we can look at a body without organs. If we can destitute the idea of a body's unity, in this case, a piano, in doing so, in taking away that overarching presupposed unity, now we are left with a series of intensities. These keys here, do these keys make sounds? Like, listen to some of the albums of Richard D. James, Aphex Twin. You can hear a very close mic on the pedals and on the hammers and that sort of thing. Those have a musical quality to it that can actually brought out through the recording process. Same with treated piano with John Cage and folks like that. And this can be done with all kinds of electronic music these days, especially those working within modular music and semi-modular. You can see all the videos online, people working with kalimbas, garbage cans, all sorts of things, solenoids, and what have you. But with that said, let's turn to Austin, and curious about your reading of the body without organs. you know, with respect to the idea that you're a forensic scientist and you are conducting autopsies and you are taking tissue samples and sending them off to laboratories and whatnot. How does your experience doing those sorts of things collide with the text here today?
So I'm going to be very historical about my reading of this. I encountered this text after I learned how to do autopsy. Autopsy is kind of a practice that's shrouded in mystery because it's at its historic nadir right now. The number of autopsies that are done is at its lowest point that it's really been in the past 100 years. So there's a lot of mystery about autopsy, what it can and can't do, what it is and what it isn't. So autopsy means to see for oneself. And what it is not a single body of knowledge. It is a set of practices, which is why it's hard to teach. So at my institution, I'm the director of autopsy. I'm also the director of the resident rotation. We've got every year we have four residents in anatomic and clinical pathology, and they rotate through the, as a first year, they rotate through the hospital autopsy service. I'm no longer a forensic pathologist, but I've trained there, and our hospital is a big trauma center, and we talk to the office of the chief medical examiner a lot. And, you know, I have a whole hour long lecture that I could do that is separate. It's about the difference between forensic and hospital autopsy. Way outside the scope of this. My job is to teach young doctors how to do autopsy and also, you know, render good results for the next of kin who have requested these things. And so one of the reasons I like autopsy is that it is a set of practices. It's not a standard formula that we enact. You can actually do a pretty good autopsy with about $20 worth of material that you get from Home Depot. The power of that is that it is the gold diagnostic standard. You can have a 3 Tesla MRI, and we can find things that cannot. You can do all sorts of laboratory studies in the hospital lab, which is also something that a pathologist learns. I'll tell you what a pathologist is in a second. And we are the gold standard. So with about $20 worth of equipment, we can diagnose things that are on the cutting edge of medical science. And it has been that way. The difficulty of teaching this is I get the residents come to me, they're about to do an autopsy, and they say, how am I going to go about this? And I say, well, we'll figure that out as we go along. And they always get a little frustrated with me. And my job as a teacher, my job as somebody who teaches these people how to do that is to sit with their frustration and not to extinguish it, to keep it going. So this is all the preamble to how I interpret the body without organs. A pathologist, and I'm going to get directly to that, a pathologist is the laboratory physician in the hospital. We are in charge of tissue that gets taken out in surgery or for biopsy to be diagnosed. And we are also in charge of all what are called the clinical labs. So if you get blood drawn, it goes to a lab. And the lab is run by the pathologist. Urine, any body fluid, any of these tests, if you get genetic testing done, all of this stuff is overseen by a pathologist. We are physicians of laboratory medicine. We have in many ways, no patients, and in many ways, all the patients. And our job is to make sure that those things are operating in an appropriate fashion. Now, my job is I am mostly an anatomic pathologist. I take surgical tissue, we cut it up, we make little slivers of it that are 5 microns thick, about the thickness of a thick piece of paper. And then we look at those under the microscope and we render diagnoses that way. So our job is to interpret the behavior of tissues and render those things in language. So aesthetics, semiotics, ontology, all these things are absolutely directly active in all the layers of my practice, and I'm very concerned with them. The interesting thing about the body without organs for me, the little edge that I was able to start peeling that sticker up with, was the fact that you have to destroy a specimen in order to render it sensible. You have to cut it apart. I look at laryngectomies all the time. ENT surgeons take a larynx out of a person that is generally filled with squamous cell carcinoma. And larynxes are very intimidating specimens for our residents, so I show them how to cut them apart and deal with them. But in the act of doing that, you destroy the thing. You destroy it productively, but it is irrevocably altered. So we perform autopsies in a respectful way, but we destroy the unity of the body. We take out all of the organs. We examine each one by serially sectioning it, slivers that are less than a centimeter in thickness. And from that, we determine what the person had in life. So if I was to generate a productive opposition here, I would make distinctions between involution, death, and decomposition. Because the person that I'm looking at, they're dead. They have died. But their tissues must still have a minimum viability for me to render diagnoses about these things. Now, in my time as a forensic pathologist, when I was looking at people who didn't die of natural causes, there was no limit on what I would take as an autopsy case. I saw many a decomp, a few skeletons that had been murdered, and render diagnoses based on those things. So where I get to the body without organs here is in this kind of frustration of a basic algebra. An organ is a functional unit within the body. Each organ has a function. You can look at the liver processes wastes. It's got certain synthetic functions as well. It makes things that our body needs. Coagulation factors, bile for digestion of fats. The thyroid produces hormones that regulate metabolism, and each organ exists as a continuation of this body. It has a purpose, and the way that I take purpose is it has a teleology. So what we do is when you go to the doctor and you get some blood drawn, they assess the health of many organs and determine how they serve the normative end of what we call health. Now, you know, when the clinical physicians, when they're rounding, for example, in the ICU, you know, they go through a checklist, essentially, of all the organ systems. You know, somebody who's really sick, they got to make sure every organ system is functioning. How's the kidney function today? Okay. But when we denude these things of a teleology, we can start talking about things that they can do. When the person is dead, I'm doing a hospital autopsy, the person is reasonably recently dead. And so the organs are not functioning, but they are still minimally alive that I can make a diagnosis here. So they have that minimum of consistency that they are still something, but they are denuded of any teleology. If you look at the Charles Dickens reference in Immanence, A Life, that little minimum quantity of living is what we are there to detect. So in that way, the autopsy, you know, in a kind of basically vulgar way, produces a body without organs. But it is itself a body without organs that does not have a specific practice about how to generate its knowledge. We are simply there to witness it. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of gestures, and my job is I very fundamentally think that I teach residents how to improvise productively.
I mean, it's fascinating. I have tons of questions, as do probably the others. As you're speaking, I'm thinking that one of the things that's quite important to you is maintaining some kind of judgment function, right? But perhaps there are times at which, I imagine, you need to bracket your biases in order to be able to see something that is rare, or maybe is hidden or imperceptible, as it were. Am I right about that? Like, talk to me about the sort of acumen that's demanded of someone performing an autopsy with respect to the idea of judgment.
Boy, howdy. Okay. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head here. So, and this is also very important in my surgical pathology. I'll get biopsies from people who have, let's say, a mat. I perform biopsies myself. Somebody will show up with a cheek mass, and I stick a needle into their face, and I pull off a microscopic drop of tissue. There's a practice called fine needle aspiration biopsy. And we put that material on a slide. At some point, I can show you guys pictures of this. This is easy to Google and what this looks like. But this is why aesthetics and judgment are incredibly important to me. Daunting thing that you realize is that anything can show up anywhere. Tumors, and this is where we can move into kind of cancer, talking about cancer. Tumors do not read books. Biology does not read books. Our knowledge of biology, our knowledge of medicine is always incomplete. So anything can show up anywhere. And you have two basic choices that before your judgment here. You can end up in a paranoiac pull in which you are almost totally immobilized. You end up making some very goofy decisions this way. So this gets into the technicalities of my work. I'll take a small piece of tissue, a very small piece of tissue, and I can do things to it called immunohistochemical studies, where I look at the proteins that are expressed by that tissue. And I've got a whole host of these things. But I have to be thrifty because I have a small piece of tissue. I can exhaust that. So I got to have some ideas. They can't be too closed and they can't be too open. So the thing here is that you can alternate between the schizophrenic pull of being open, or you can go to the paranoiac pull where you are trying to encompass all possible positions. And honestly, before I ever encountered this text, I was deep into mea su, because the absolute contingency with which you are encountering this is very similar to the what can a body do. Biometaphysics is very different than hyperchaos, but they sure taste pretty similar when you're actually trying to do something with your life. So we start with an aesthetic judgment. We start with an aesthetic perception, and then we move to a judgment. And this is all encountered obliquely, and it is an open set. And this is the frustration of teaching. This is the frustration of teaching the residents. You guide them through this, and there are risks. And there are definitely people's lives who are on the line here. And you must have caution. And the specific nature of that caution is never closed either. And so our job is to take them through this process while doing it. And, you know, this process resists any type of totalizing, pithy type of statement. So I'm just not going to try and do that. I'll just stop talking.
Adam, you got something?
Yeah, I just want to ask a question about, I was thinking about the idea of the body of our organs as something very nomadic, and thinking about the ideas of the map versus the territory, royal science versus nomadic science, and how this notion of the body of our organs would tie into the process of autopsy in terms of, you know, subtracting the unity of the body and treating it like a territory of, in which various kind of things that a lot of radical contingencies, ultimately the contingency of sense of how various flows have been obstructed. It's not like it doesn't seem like a diagnosis according to, okay, you have the map of these, the organs should be doing all this. You look for the contingencies, the problematic becomes central to it. And this is, I mean, there's actually a really good video up on YouTube by Jacob Geller. It's like a big sort of tribute to the autopsy as kind of the last first responders, as I phrase it, I quite like. So I just wanted to ask, how does the notion of sense and sort of territoriality, what does the body become under that kind of experimental problematic gaze? I know we've already covered it to some extent, but you know, this lack of unity or the possibility of, or the categories in a way don't have to be fully adhered to. An autopsy happens because some system has encountered a blockage, it essentially has broken down and has gone through a sort of process of involution. So I just wanted to ask, what would be the distinction between, say, the royal science of, say, medical diagnostics, diagnosing the living, and these of the nomadic science of autopsy, which in many ways is, in being like the last first responders, is actually sort of more in touch with the contingencies of a life itself. And I think the reference to the Imminence of Life paper is absolutely that, because it's judgment has to be selective in the same way the body of our organs must ration a bit of judgment, ration a bit of subjectivation. In a way, in being sort of the last first responders, you're responding to the event as such rather than, well, we need to go in this direction here. So this is purely a sort of, I'll say in the moment, but in the Actually, yeah, fuck it. In the moment, in the Nietzschean moment, the blink of an eye, the Augen blick.
So I can really, I'm going to relate this to the recent history of medical thinking. You know, about 1970s, 1980s, the way that most physicians were trained was through a process called pathophysiological reasoning. You were given a set of reasonable parameters, which you use to generate problem spaces. You know, if you do this to this happens, if you do that to that happens, and then you encounter, you then are able to generate a kind of mechanistic framework for any particular patient and reason your way through that. And then there's another development called evidence-based medicine, which said, you know, we think that these mechanistic principles are reasonable, but it turns out they are not. And we can use statistics to show that when you are in this situation, this is the appropriate thing to do, regardless of what you, the particularities of the situation you perceive. And so the royal science of medicine has become this, quote, evidence-based medicine, where you have a lot of people using statistics in interesting ways. And so this is, so that has become our royal science. Now, what is absolutely fascinating to me is that I have a background in chemistry. I did, when I was in college, I did 4 years. I stayed every summer and did 4 years of chemistry research in synthetic organometallic chemistry. I also did a heck of a lot of stuff in computational biochemistry, which is a fancy way of saying how quantum mechanics influences biochemistry. I have a minor in mathematics. I've done a lot of quantum mechanics in my time. I prefer to call it statistical mechanics because it kind of, I don't know, the quantum mechanics sounds so sexy, and then people import a lot of like science fiction nonsense, and it's really much spookier. The body is, in statistical mechanic terms, a non-ergodic system. If you have a container and you have a gas in it, you can reasonably presume that the gas molecules will occupy over time all of the positions in the container. This is not true for a body. A body in its history will not occupy all of the potential spaces that it is afforded geographically, physiologically. These limitations, this particularity of the history can't be predetermined based on the problem space. And so if we use statistics to start saying we're going to encompass all potentiality this way, we end up denuding and impoverishing a lot of our cognitive tools. One of the reasons I like autopsy is because it does not do this. It does not function this way. It does not function with counterfactual arguments are really useful in talking about potential spaces. However, in a body, all of the history in a deceased person, in a person who has died, who is receiving an autopsy, all of those potentialities are gone. And the actualities have basically all collapsed. The person is not living anymore. They do not occupy any particular physiologic potential space. It's done. And so the purpose of autopsy, as I see it in a Deleuzian fashion, is a Deleuzo-Guattarian fashion, is to frustrate the facile gestures that we come to by the royal sciences that we've come to use. And so it frustrates me that autopsy has, you know, kind of is at a nadir in its practice. I wrote a paper about this, and I did not in that paper approach this from a Deleuze-Guattarian end. I talked about it from this concept of being towards death, and I built through a concept of statistical nihilism towards Derrida, essentially. That's how I was feeling that summer when I needed to write this thing. So that's what I did. I've kind of worked through that. Those feelings are published and I can move on now.
Sure. How about Matt or Will?
Yeah, like I find the commentary about autopsy to be really interesting because in the history of pathological anatomy, whether we're talking about like Bichat or Morghani or, you know, the original point of the autopsy was to attempt to sort of evade this understanding of like cadaverous time, right? It was an attempt to, well, what autopsy needs to do is it needs to like close the distance between the living and the dead, right? It needs to try to kind of come in at the last possible instance of pathological time, right? And give an account of that pathological time just as the body is entering the first stage of, in the 19th century, what would be called the cadaveric, or even in the 18th century. So, like, my question here is, at this point, like, autopsy, both, at least in, like, for, like, lay folks like myself, right? Like, autopsy is both a thin line, but it seems like it's trying to attempt to sort of get rid of this separation between the pathological and the cadaveric by allowing for the body to become a surface that can give an account of, let's say, where a disease left a bite, right? Like, that's the comment by Hunter, right? Like, the body is no longer alive, but if the disease leaves its fangs somewhere, if we organize clinics the right way, if we open up corpses immediately, if we reduce the latency period between death and autopsy, all of these things can allow for an understanding of not what occurred, but what is occurring, right? Like, the most impossibly alive tissue to give an account of what is actually happening to the body. So my question then becomes, like, how do we understand contemporary medicine when this epistemic framework of the body being a surface of symptoms is kind of something that dissipates in the 20th century, right? How can autopsy relate to our understanding of how different cancers organize, reproduce? Because it seems to me that, like, what muscular tissue can allow for, you know, is to give an account of different ways in which cancer treatments fail, right? And, like, one thing that, again, from like a lay perspective, I've noticed over the last like 10 years is the increasing impossibility for like conventional treatment of cancer. Like, what you'll notice with like Sloan Kettering and other groups like that is that cancer treatment is, or even just your dog, right? Your dog gets sick. And what they do is they attempt 17 different treatments in the course of like 6 weeks. And I'm wondering if this practice of medical failure, right? Of like giving an account of medical failure helps us to understand the gap in ontological practices between the map and the territory. So I'm wondering, how important is this practice to understand cancer as a body without organs?
So most of our understanding of cancer at present has nothing to do with autopsy, because autopsy is going away largely. There are a few places that are doing rapid autopsy protocols for certain types of cancer. Johns Hopkins has like a rapid autopsy protocol for metastatic prostate cancer. But ultimately, you know, this is not globalized. You open up a couple interesting questions here, which is, what is the import for autopsy for cancer at present? And the answer is, it's low. It's, you know, it's particular. It's case by case. There's no generalized data harvesting mechanism for doing that. And that's kind of part of one of the problems that faces people who do autopsy these days. The ability of autopsy to make assertions is reciprocally related to the diagnostic categories that are out there now, which is how autopsy can always refresh itself, because it happens at the same time as other things. You know, I had a patient who died very suddenly, a young, healthy person who died very suddenly, and the heart was kind of the victim villain of the thing. There was a lot of inflammation in the heart, and I did not know why it was there. Judging by the blood tests that had been taken in the very short premortem interval before the person died, I would have said Lyme disease. But because I'm a laboratorian, I know that testing for Lyme disease is a deep, weird, goofy place, and that I knew that it probably wasn't Lyme disease. So what I did was I sent the tissue out for PCR, genetic analysis, to see what viruses were in there. I sent it to the CDC in Atlanta. And they determined that it was,
let's see,
I've done this a couple times and I can't keep them straight. Could have been the Coxsackie virus. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was parvovirus. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter to this conversation. So the deal is that whatever particular tools we use evolves along with medicine. Now, your question is, yes, we have kind of reached, I don't know, I feel pretty crummy about for-profit healthcare. And I feel limited by the amount of care that can be given for cancer. There are individual places that give excellent care, but I feel like our conceptualization of cancer is inadequate at this point. And this speaks to exactly what you're kind of proposing here, which is that this, you know, if medicine has very normative functions, and I have heard Will speak on his reluctance to about doctors who have read Foucault. And I take that very seriously, personally, because he doesn't have to worry because I've never met any doctors that have read Foucault. But the actualization of that is immaterial. I think that cancer represents, and I think a body without organs is a great model to start building a different type of concept of cancer. We have an idea of cancer that is genetically driven. And yet we find tumors where we perform genetic analysis. And this, I would have to like give this forum a really big, long excursus on genetics and how genetics works. And you guys could absolutely understand it, but that would take up your whole episode here. But the fact is that the genes themselves do not have an ultimate totalizable teleology. So we are going to have to deploy some body without organs type thinking if we are going to continue to develop people, how we handle people who have cancer. I kind of think about there are probably a number of things in medicine that could go away if we didn't do for-profit medicine. But I kind of think about this like I think about policing. I'm not going to argue for police here or anything like that. But a homicide is a homicide. What you do about it is different, but murder is a murder. Cancer is cancer. While there are a number of cancers that would possibly go away if we did not have plastics and oil industry and that type of thing, we would still have to contend with this. And so we would have to have sophisticated ways of thinking about murder and cancer and how to handle those things. And I think because the body without organs presents this kind of denuded concept of the way that things work and it engages with potentialities, I think this is a very powerful way to start thinking about those types of things. So I'm sorry, Will's sophisticated questioning is one of my favorite things about this show. And I stand here naked before it.
As you were talking about sort of statistics, you were sort of talking about statistical models rather than quantum, I suppose. That's the distinction you set up, right? Because the implications that it draws in. And I can't recall exactly where it was, but I remember there's an interesting discussion in, I think, the Geology of Moles Plateau, where Deleuze and Guattari discuss theories of evolution, I think it is, isn't it? And they sort of talk about old models of sort of filiation and might not be alliance, it's similar sort of terms. And then newer models which talk in terms of molar aggregates, right? Sort of statistical aggregates in which intensive differences carry out in a progressive way over time. So maybe there's I can't recall, it's been a little while since I went back to that plateau. But if anyone's sort of listening, it may be interesting to go back to the Geology of Moles and pick that up and have a look and see if it's relevant. The thought I wanted to sort of offer here is that there's, in a way, to return to what Will said at the start about the ethical component to this, because the title of the plateau is how do you make yourself a body without organs? I often come away from this plateau, I've read it a few times now, and normally when I finish it, I still don't feel I actually know what the answer to that question is, but there's an interesting passage here, which I think clarifies some, at least quite a bit of this in sort of the ethical element, where they say, and I'm using the Routledge version on 185, they say, let's consider the three great strata concerning us. In other words, the ones that most directly bind us, the organism, significance, and an interpretation, and a point of subjectification or subjection. You will be organized, you will be an organism, you will articulate your body, otherwise you're just depraved, and so on. And they go on to say that what would it mean to disarticulate, to cease to be an organism, the extent to which we do it every day, and how necessary caution is, the art of dosages, since overdose is a danger. You don't do it with a sledgehammer, you use a very fine file. You invent self-destructions that have nothing to do with a death drive. And I wonder if, I don't want to make every episode return to themes we endlessly explore, but there is this sort of element of desubjectivation at work here. It's almost how does one refuse to be what one is, right, in order to become something else? And this is just me emphasizing something that they don't necessarily emphasize, but they do specifically say that subjectification is part of this. And so maybe part of what the body of our organs can offer us, aside from new ways of understanding on the sort of literal level for the human body, there's also the sort of molar aggregates that we can understand as body of our organs too, in which if we look at it in those ways, sort of in the social field, the political field, etc., we can begin to explore new possibilities for organization, etc., or deorganization even, right? And then the question is, how does the individual sort of link up the molar with the molecular? I suspect that Will's onto something there with when you talk about in terms of ethical practices, and maybe Foucault would be a useful one, actually, in a way, although Will didn't mention him by name this time, because it seems like the concern is the same here. It's the possibility of individual and collective self-transformation, right? Embodied in specific ethical practices, which seek to carve out a space of freedom, perhaps, against what they call sort of subjectification, significance, etc., an organization. And as a sort of final note, one of the things I find a little bit difficult, I suppose, when I think about the body of our organs in the more, let's say, literal sense, sort of the human body in that sort of context, I think I always struggle to understand what it would mean, I suppose, to de-organize, as they sometimes put it, the body in that sense. Because presumably it isn't just, drinking orange juice through your nose or something, right? Like, right, there's more to it than this. But I think when I try and sort of see it as, if we take bodies in the Spinozist sense and understand that that doesn't just mean human organs, it also means things like various elements or sort of strata of social field, the political domain in which we act, then it starts to make perhaps, I feel something, there's something strangely more to me to grasp onto, even though it's perhaps even more abstract there, because then you can make these sort of linkages, I think. And it's an interesting passage here where they talk about it, where they say, just maybe this is my final sort of point, they say that dismantling the organism has never meant killing yourself, but rather opening the body to connections that presuppose an entire assemblage. Circuits, conjunctions, levels and thresholds, passages and distributions of intensity and territories dismantling the organism is no more difficult. And deterritorialization is measured with the craft of a surveyor. So I suppose part of what they're trying to advise that we do, help us to explore, is the ways in which we can experiment with ideas of like not only who we are and who we should be, how we should be. And that this is always, there's no binary here, like individual, collective per se, because as they say, it's always, we're always sort of opening the body to connections that presuppose an entire assemblage. And there's always multiple assemblages, because we're always part of these different circuits and systems. And so the question is, how do we open ourselves to that such that we can transform it and be transformed by them? So there's this very sort of clear ethical element, I think, in this. And I kind of love it because I get my sort of, it's like a avant-garde Spinoza stuff, it's great. A bit different. Sorry, that was a little bit of a ramble, but I just wanted to throw some ideas out there.
So, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the show. And one of the things that I'm a huge fan of is Matt's ability to provide a disjunctive synthesis in the form of an amazing question that opens up something great. So I want to take this out of the technical realm. There's a wonderful parable. There's a wonderful film version of The Body Without Organs. And this is the second to last episode of The Prisoner, the 1967 TV show starring Patrick McGoohan. The whole plot of The Prisoner is that there's a secret agent. He's a British secret agent, and he is quitting his job. And this is spoilers for a 50-year-old TV show, but a lot of this is done in the opening credits. He's quitting his job, and he, filled with anger, you don't hear the conversation, and he goes back to his apartment and begins planning a new life, I'm guessing, in some tropical island somewhere. And the apartment fills with some type of anesthetic gas. He loses consciousness and wakes up in his apartment again. And he opens the curtain, and what does he see there but a totally different place? No longer London. He sees this Italianate English resort community where all of his needs are provided for, provided that his needs are provided for. And in the course of the show, he realizes that he's a prisoner there, and he's referred to as a number six, and the person in charge of the place is always a number two. And which begs the question, who is number one? And the cool part about the show, the cool part about the narrative is that you can pretty much watch the episodes in any order you'd like, with the exception of the first and the last two. And in the second to last episode, he is given the opportunity to perhaps meet number one. But what he has to do is he has to pass through what is called a test. The test is called the degree absolute. And so he and number two, the jailer, get locked in a place called the embryo room, where they go through a number of psychodramas. The embryo room looks like a set for a Beckett play. And each psychodrama is a dominant and submissive person, where number two plays the dominant and number six plays the submissive. Some type of authority figure versus some type of subservient. Parent and child, teacher and student, boss and worker, and the final one is the role of the jailer and the prisoner. So, I mean, immediately this calls to mind the kind of movement through thresholds in the postscript of Control. And the dramas progress and they become increasingly like almost violent. And they are told when they enter this room that one of them will die. Only one person can survive this. So we get to the end of the final drama, the prisoner and the jailer, which is like so on the nose, of course. And it seems that Six has been like totally devastated. He's destroyed. And then something miraculous happens. He begins counting backwards from 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and 0. And at which point he wins. He becomes himself again. And the kind of mantra of the show is, I am not a number, I am a free man. And so he finishes at this 0 point. The 0 point is the point of maximum potentiality and maximum risk. That is why we must take caution. There is no wisdom for handling this particular 0 point. If you go to page 160 in the Minnesota edition, you have to keep enough of the organism for it to reform each dawn. And you have to keep small supplies of significance and subjectification, if only to turn them against their own systems when the circumstances demand it. When things, persons, and even situations force you to, you have to keep small rations of subjectivity in sufficient quantity to enable you to respond to the dominant reality. Mimic the strata. You don't reach the body without organs and its plane of consistency by wildly destratifying. That is why we encountered the paradox of those emptied and drearied bodies at the very beginning. They have emptied themselves of their organs instead of looking for the point at which they could patiently and momentarily dismantle the organization of the organs we call the organism. And so, you know, this is, I mean, like, what is that but caution? That is caution right there. And so, you know, this is what I try to do as a physician, because we create these bodies without organs. You know, in medicine, they tend to refer to the pediatrics patient as the most vulnerable patient. And I take only minimal exception to that. I think the dead people are our most vulnerable patient because they do not speak for themselves. All of their tissues must pass through the judgment of somebody like me. And this is why I'm very particular with how I articulate myself, especially in reports, because I must have caution. If you'd like to read more, Mark Fisher's thesis on Gothic materialism, his discussion of the flatline is exactly this.
Well, Austin, I want to get back to something important that you discussed in the reading group with respect to cancer. And you had mentioned that, in fact, different kinds of cancers have different manners of expression, different manners of development and unfolding. And when you were talking about that, it made me think of Deleuze and Guattari's refashioning of the notion of the death drive, which runs very close to their notion of the body without organs. Their whole conceptualization of death rests upon the idea of the body without organs. How something comes to die is contingent upon the set of factors that condition the desire that brings about its death. I'm thinking, for example, too, I have just a more basic question, which is, in terms of Deleuze and Guattari, and then in terms of, you know, your knowledge, the epistemology of the autopsy performer, the forensic pathologist, how does something die? Given your knowledge of Deleuze and Guattari and what you've worked on before, if you could combine those discourses, maybe that's something that you could answer amidst explaining to us how it is that cancer takes over cells and the different ways in which different kinds of cancers manifest.
I run into this problem frequently. In my role as a hospital physician, as a hospital pathologist, I do not do autopsies on people who died of non-natural causes. In the Commonwealth of Virginia, those are definitionally medical examiner's cases. Mm. We're a big trauma center. So we get people who come in who die of non-natural causes. And sometimes they die a long time later. And so the physicians and nurses will occasionally forget to report these things to the medical examiner. This isn't a huge issue. This is part of my job. So I do a lot of education with respect to what is a medical examiner's case. And it's anything that is a non-natural death. I cannot encyclopedically index all of those particular cases. Death itself is very much a minor science. It does not have a central rigor. It is not a closed set. It is not complete. Heck, trauma is almost, you know, if we were to go the J.G. Ballard route, you know, by a crash, you know, trauma is an open set of almost artistic practices. So cancer, on the other hand, is also an open set. It is not a closed set. And this is where Deleuze and Guattari are very useful in that they are going against Plato here. The vast majority of the way that we consider cancer is via this kind of Neoplatonic ideal. My big currency, because I deal with head and neck cancer, which a lot of it is smoking, drinking related, is squamous cell carcinoma. So the lining of the oropharynx and the aerodigestive tract gets insulted by HPV, gets insulted by the various carcinogens that live in cigarette smoke, that gets driven potentially by alcohol. And all these things kind of sit in this milieu on this lining that can become proliferative and invasive and immortal. When you think about how squamous cell carcinoma develops, it happens because the machinery of proliferation become unchecked. The cell in itself, when it divides, has its own incredibly complicated set of mechanisms to provide a disjunctive synthesis to stop the division of cells. Yeah. And we use those things as weapons in diagnosing. For example, HPV will live for a long period of time in some type of cell, generally in the tonsil or in the base of tongue. And over 20 years, the genome gets integrated into the person's genome. The two genomes become one. And they disrupt the checkpoint machinery that would stop a cell from dividing. And the cells begin to divide, and they don't die. And they escape recognition by the immune system in some cases. And so HPV-mediated squamous cell carcinoma is a big thing that I deal with. The cancer, one of the things we like to think about it is like as a parasite. It's latched onto us. It's using our resources. And it is. But it is totally unaware of us. And it has a logic. And it has desires and drives. This is, you know, a lot of people don't understand what I have to do when I get a surgical resection of these things. I fill out a report that describes the behaviors of this particular cancer. Does it like nerves? Is it going into the lymphovasculature? Is it destroying bone? All of these things are about its particular behaviors. Now, I've never seen a generic squamous cell carcinoma before. I have only ever seen particular instances of squamous cell carcinoma. And this is where we get into the serial repetitions versus the Neoplatonic elsewhere. You know, most physicians, if, you know, they haven't really considered their ontology very much. And that's not because they're dumb whatsoever. It's because they're so smart, they don't have to. So they generally deal with these things as class categories by a kind of Platonic ideal. Here's this particular tumor. It doesn't have these features. So these are the accidental deformations, but this is the thing that it belongs to. But I find that it's far more powerful to consider these things as repetitions, which are, and the accidents are thereby masks of what is being repeated. And this is what the cells themselves are individually doing, because if you look at the genetics of the tumor cell population, they are very different from one another in many cases. Sometimes they are all the same, sometimes they are different. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, this is true in a normal, healthy organism. Your immune cells have a very different genetic profile than the rest of your body. This is how you're able to make antibodies. So I hate to give any credence to the anti-vaxxer people, but vaccines do change your genetics. They don't change everything's genetics, but they do produce differing genetics in the memory T and memory B cells that hang out in your body. So the organism itself, this is where I get really uncomfortable with the death drive and talking about it, because I am not as sophisticated with handling that. Mm-hmm. Where I think about this is that the cancer doesn't care about death drive anymore. I don't think that it has a death drive in kind of like the vulgar sense. Like, that's the whole problem. Most of the cells in your body respect what they're supposed to be doing and can be killed. In fact, you know, the space between your fingers happened because when you were a fetus, programmed cell death deleted the cells that are in between. They involuted. The practice of involution is productive and helps the life of the organism. So the individual death helps the individual, helps the aggregate life. The cancer cell has no respect for these things. What they are trying to do now, there's a very trendy thing to do, and it works pretty well, is to see if there are death drive markers on the surface of these cancer cells, and then to provoke them with a drug. You can give a drug to a person and it will tell those cells, if they express it, I should just kill myself right now. So is there a minimum of that in those cells? And, you know, if I could show you pictures of how we determine this, it's very much a molar versus molecular determination. And statistics are a huge part of this. And it's, if I showed you this, you'd get very frustrated with it. Anyway, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. I think I mentioned to you in the reading group, and I know the folks that I work with on the show here know this. I had cancer about 10 to 12 years ago. And basically, it was a tumor that had grown out of a birthmark that I had on my scalp. And I'm about to talk about something a little bit gross. Listeners, be prepared for that. I'll probably talk for about a minute or two on it. But anyway, I didn't have insurance at the time. Actually, it was kind of in between situations, but I started using a crystalline vitamin C, direct application of that, sometimes with coconut oil. And I actually didn't have to do this very long, probably within over the course of 2 or 3 days. Basically, a reaction took place that looked very similar to what you saw in Fight Club when he put that chemical burn on his arm. And over the course of 2 or 3 days, this tumor that was on my scalp basically got drained of all the liquid and turned almost to like an ash and like crusted off after 2 or 3 days, leaving the small footprint of where the tumor was. Now, I had went and seen the oncologist, you know, I think I saw him 2 or 3 weeks later, and he saw that everything was gone. He's like, well, what happened here? And I said, I used this. He's like, well, we're still going to have to do something about that. You understand that, right? And which I did, of course. I had an excision and everything's been fine since. But it was interesting experiencing in a very gruesome and hands-on sort of way, seeing this accelerated cell death right before my eyes. It was almost as if, and this was the science that I was told, and I don't recommend that anybody try. This is not medical advice. But, you know, I was kind of at my wit's end and desperate in that moment. But in doing so, like I said, you know, I was able to see what I believed was an accelerated cell death of these cancer cells. The theory was that vitamin C triggered them to engage in mitosis or something like that, and they would accelerate their cell death and break down, which then led me to a series of questions going back to what you said about HPV hiding out in the body. It seems that the strategies of cancer, if you will, often in some sense defy the invasive modalities or the allopathic modalities that a lot of medical practitioners practice, which is, okay, let's use this attributive schema. Those are the bad ones. These are the good ones. Let's just excise that region, sew it up, you know, give it a shot of chemo and hope for the best. But it seems that the level of sophistication that something like the HPV virus has, for example, is so high in some ways. It really challenges us to think, how do we address an illness that has staged its occupation of the body over a 20-year period? I mean, are medical practitioners like you or others, are they thinking in terms of developing strategies that go beyond this sort of normal procedure of just cut it, gut it, and sew it up?
Absolutely. One of the nice things about HPV-driven squamous cell carcinomas is they actually tend to behave really a lot better than the ones who aren't. They tend to be exquisitely sensitive to radiation, like very targeted radiation, not like whole body stuff. So people with that tend to do really well. But then there are all sorts of things that we've called undifferentiated. There are all these undifferentiated tumors. And we're starting to find genetic drivers for them. But part of the problem is the topology of genetics. Okay, if we can identify the gene that is in the particular cell, then we can kill that particular cell. Except the genes don't live on the surface of the cell, they live on the inside of the cell. So most of our chemotherapy accesses the cell from the inside. So the real thing that people are very much working on is figuring out how to expose the interior of the cell so that we can figure out which cells need to go and which cells can stay. And then that gives us a huge number of options. And that is a huge problem. Frankly, that's kind of what my organometallic synthetic background in chemistry was designing. We weren't doing drug design. We were doing very primitive stuff in the lineage of the development of a drug that would eventually give access possibly to those to those things. How do you tell which cell is wild and out and which cell is not? And people are absolutely working on that all the time. The funniest thing is, like, in high school and college and medical school, you relearn the Krebs cycle, the basic way the body digests glucose at the cellular level, and you learn it and you relearn it, and then you kind of forget it and you don't really use it, but it's a tough trial to get through. And that is just one little tiny portion of all the ways that these cells are being exploited by people in order to try and treat these things. There are drugs that come out all the time, and this is how we then end up, you know, not the research is done by research institutions, and then a lot of the drug development is done by the private corporations. And then we've entered into a totally different stratum here than simply how a simple physician, let's say an oncologist, is trying to work with these things. You know, so if the reason that this stuff is important to me is because it works on the brute technical level of what I do. It also works on the social level of how I teach this stuff. And it also gives me a good political program for what I need to advocate for. Because if you encounter, any given oncologist, these people are doing excellent work. They have done this. Not because they want to make $1 million. I don't know an oncologist who makes $1 million. I don't know an oncologic surgeon who makes $1 million. These people are doing this, and they destroy their bodies. They deny themselves food and sleep for years. Not because they want to get rich, but because they think that this is a valuable thing to deal with. And they get captured. This is why the apparatus of capture chapter is huge to me. Is how do you take these people with these noble ambitions and then capture them in this process here? How do you capture these PhD research scientists at public universities? And how do you capture that work into something that, I don't know, I wouldn't want to have cancer.
One last question that I have for you, and this is, I guess, a little bit of a tangent from what we're talking about, but I can imagine if I were in your position performing autopsies on the daily, seeing necrotic tissue, the breakdown of the body, how has this experience overall informed the way that you see your own body and treat your own body?
I'm much more of a vegetarian now. I'm not like totally vegetarian. I mean, I have a deep sympathy for the non-human, but I also like, I don't think that my non-participation in the meat economy is something that's like going to make it go away. I'm not that facile of a thinker. You deal with enough like crunchy aortas and you're like, maybe hamburgers are not the way to go.
I don't know. I got kind of hungry when you said crunchy aorta. Like, give me some avocado.
We'll let you see an autopsy. You can hold an aorta and hear it crack. And you won't like that much anymore. I mean, the whole process of learning to do this is a complete rearrangement of your senses, which in every way changes your subjectivity. So I can remember a previous subject that I was, but I can see its contiguity with the current subject that I am. You know, I do biopsies on people, and I am not infrequently the first person to tell another person that they have cancer. And you have to be really, you have to take caution. I never know who, I can tell when people are ready and when they're not. They're going to have an oncologist. They're going to meet with an oncologist and that type of thing. I'm not withholding information from anybody, but there are people who would like to know, and there are people where that would be destructive. And so I think the real question is that you would like to have the ability, a patient entering the hospital is never going to know as much as the people who've spent years studying this stuff. So there is always a huge danger for those people who know these things to wield power over those who don't. And when you give a patient a choice, it needs to be a real choice. And there is not going to be a final verification of whether or not that was a just choice to approach them with. It is not a consumer scenario. You know, this is my, you know, the recent law where they said, you know, hospitals should publish all their prices for all their equipment online is a total misunderstanding of how people enter into medical care. That's an absurd, meaningless gesture. I'm sorry, but like looking at a giant, super duper huge spreadsheet for like all the little prices for everything on there is not the stratum on which medical decisions are made. What my generation was taught was patient-centered care. And if I had like a philosophical project that I was pursuing as a physician, it would be the almost non-human patient-centered care. Any physician who's listening to this is going to be like, non-human. It's okay. By treating the person as an irreducible singularity, totally unknowable, totally untheorizable, we certainly give ourselves a lot of latitude. You know, what we end up doing there is we give ourselves a huge amount of latitude to dominate the situation. If the desires of the other person are a complete singularity, unable to be examined, unable to be explored, then we actually end up dominating them. David Graeber talks about this beautifully in The Dawn of Everything, in that by treating the other as a complete singularity, totally dimensionless, a total black hole with an event horizon that is unbreachable, we actually give ourselves a fair amount of ethical latitude there. And I think if we start exploring the ways in which we aren't human, that which is not human within the human, and we deal with our own subjectivity in a way that we can actually begin to do new ethical things that are far more patient-centered than simply the facile gesture of calling it patient-centered care. Yeah, we do patient-centered care. It becomes a refrain. And I like to frustrate refrains. I often say I have an allergy to cliches. And this is, you know, get deep into McLuhan there anyway.
Some of the questions I think we get with the idea of, you know, the idea of making a body of our organs, we have a question of agency here. And I think thinking about the idea of frustrating refrains is very central to that kind of agency, because a circuit of desire is ultimately something habitual. It becomes habitual, it becomes a rhythm. And the body of organs is essentially a circuit breaker or a short-circuiting function from which counter habits can be developed. And if your counter habits are too active, then, you know, essentially you never really do anything, or you end up in a cancerous situation of the body of our organs. And of course, you know, we have the examples they give of inflation in terms of the body of our organs of money, and also fascism. And that is really, you are just a body completely dominated by a desire, completely sealed up to the world, and your desire is no longer yours. You've sort of de-stratified so much, your desire is purely desire of the nation, of the race, or of the Führer. I mean, literally the leader, the one who directs this desire, directs this system, the steering principle, which gives you positive and negative feedback as to how this body is going in accordance to the desire that structures it. And I think ultimately, when it comes to this idea of counter habits, this thing, well, if it's all just desire at the end of the day, well, you know, where do I come into this? Where do I have this moment of saying, I am not a number, I'm a free man, or I am not an organism, I am a free man kind of thing? And I think it's ultimately a question of, what do you want? There's a body of our organs where there is desire. And ultimately, it has to be the question of cultivating a post-capitalist desire which is already there. And this is why I think this question can be answered very well in the work of Mark Fisher, particularly the later works, because his whole reframing of the problematic of capitalist realism is actually, capitalist realism isn't just this pervasive atmosphere. He's giving it too much credit there, and he knows he is, because later on he says, no, this is something which is a product of active repression, which is always going on. There is always something trying to repress desire, which is always there. So insofar as neoliberalism kind of presupposes desire, which it fights against, it also has to presuppose the very body of our organs that can generate a counter habit to neoliberal ways of being. So I think the question and the danger of the body of our organs plateau is, well, how do you make one? Or who am I to make one? Well, you're something that wants something. There's a desire there. And that's the danger. The caution is, can you follow this desire? Or can you sort of get death drunk on it to this point in which death is no longer a framing, or deactivation of the circuit of desire is ever possible? We don't have to mention the name of peoples who've very much tried this process, of course, gone too far. The fascists, of course, and the neo-reactionaries being key examples of this desire, which spun out into terminal commodification takeover, as one of them once called it. But, you know, I think this notion of agency is something that is both distorted and reclaimed by the body of our organs as a notion. The idea that we could desire differently, in the ways we are, it's about sort of finding desires you didn't necessarily know you had. And if desires are products, then there isn't always going to be a post-capitalist desire. It opens things up to elements of competition, essentially competing desires over the same surfaces of the same territory. This is where you get the idea, of course, of a new earth. The body of our organs that is post-capitalist desire is the desire for a new earth.
Will, anything to take us out?
Yeah, I was considering going down to the restaurant that we were at a few weeks ago and then grabbing a hamburger, but I think I'm going to stay home. I think I'm going to eat some celery or something. But yeah.
Well, Austin, I just wanted to say thanks for coming on. You've been a great reader in the reading group, a super contributor, and this discussion will go down in history as one of the most legit discussions of the body without organs on record to date. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. I know. I own way too many of your t-shirts.
Gotta rep it. Yep.
Well,
printtrip.com.
If I were to give one takeaway to the audience, is that cancer and death, at best, have a metastable theorization. They cannot be, there is no general concept. And so there's a lot of risk there. But one of the magical things that does happen is we can recognize them. Somehow we are able to recognize them. So we have this resistance, and then we have the ability to identify them and the ability to cultivate the identification and exploration of these things. I want to leave you with one last vulgar physical metaphor here. The rarest human cancer is the cancer of the parathyroid gland. We have four little parathyroid glands. They sit right next to and underneath our thyroid. And their job is to regulate calcium in our body, bone density and calcium levels. This is important for a lot of reasons. Somebody who has hyperparathyroidism, an overactive parathyroid gland, they feel like they're losing their mind. And if you've ever met somebody with hyperparathyroidism, it's striking. They are almost manic and they cannot hold an idea in their head. And we can do a little tiny surgery and remove a parathyroid gland and they come back to themselves. And their subjectivity, their original subjectivity that they were enjoying returns. And it is absolutely amazing. One of the few surgeries that you can do that has a distinct psychiatric effect. But parathyroid cancer is different. And parathyroid cancer is difficult to diagnose because we can cut that gland out and we can feel it and we can look at it under the microscope and we cannot diagnose that it is a cancer. We only know it to be a cancer later on when it has invaded something or metastasized. We only know it really firmly via an empirical investigation, by its affects. And this is kind of like a good limit case for our own humility, is that's the transcendental empiricist kind of point of view, is that we have to wait and see what's going to happen here. And we should not overcode those possibilities with a bunch of garbage that we've been cultivating beforehand. This is freedom and this is risk. You know, one of the things that I see in the reading group when people are trying to get a handle on this is, that's really interesting. But what do we do? If you want a new master, you will have it. And that is the risk. So there's always that Nietzschean question of what should we desire to desire? And I like that Deleuze and Guattari don't tell us that. You know, we get into a double bind where we have, you know, that the double bind, the double pincered lobster god of living. And, you know, the master-slave dialectic of, you know, like contractual being, you know, what new contracts should we enter into and that type of thing. And this is why I think Deleuze and Guattari are interested in the sadomasochistic system. And this is the resonance that when I came to this, like I am a repeated reader of Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, which is a big, chunky, schizophrenically voiced work of cybernetic capture of any number of little tiny wonderful human people that just get sucked up into that dialectic. The body itself is the starting point, and if we can return to it in our theorization of this, it's not a point necessarily of escape. It's a new point where we can bring in the new. You know, that the ability that in Gravity's Rainbow, Thomas Pynchon never occupies one particular voice. He bounces between those particular voices, and you can read people who mimic it, and you can tell where the real Thomas Pynchon, there is a real Thomas Pynchon there, and it is that plane of consistency that is where the correspondence of this sequence of voices is either above or below or just another stratum. And you don't want to totally give up your body, but you want to have a consistency that has a viability beyond any of these particularities. And so, you know, we do that for as long as we can, and that's what we can do. And if you want to know what I've gotten from doing a bunch of autopsies and looking at the kind of expression on people's faces that they have when they're done, when the subjectivity is gone and yet there is still a body there, it's that. We do this as long as we can, and we try and do it better. And, you know, I've gotten quieter and quieter with what I will say about a particular dead person. I think that's approaching my own zero in the embryo room. I want to be as quiet as possible to let those things speak. So if I've gotten better at anything, I hope it is that I have gotten better at listening.